Okay, Boker Tov, everybody. Shushan Purim Sameach, and I hope everybody's doing well. Had an enjoyable Purim. I don't know if there's anybody here from Yerushalayim. From the names that I see, I don't think so, but I imagine if they would be, they wouldn't be this week. So anyways, okay, let's continue with class number 25 in our ongoing series on the Siddur. So we were just talking, thank Rabbi Yam, we were just talking about the Ayal, the ram that came up last week. When is it brought? And we pointed out outside, of course, of all the Yamim Tovi, when you bring one Ayal, except on Sukkot, when everything is doubled, as we spoke, because Sukkot is a dual holiday, so you bring two Elim. Basically, just the Korbanot Hashem, pretty much, and are brought as an Ayal. Those are the, we mentioned last night a little bit, the sin offerings for sins you know you did, generally. Anyways, but okay, but that's, and it would be part of the Tzon. We distinguish between son and bakar. Bakar is a, you know, cattle, and son, I don't know, flocks is lighter animals. We have in, let's say, by Hilchot Tefillin, we have a distinction. We call it not son and bakar, but I don't know if it's exactly the same. Maybe it is. I assume it's the same. We distinguish between a behema gasa and a behema daka, like a thick animal and a thin animal. Like when you get your tefillin, so it's more mehudar. It's more, it's a higher level if it's a behema gasa, like from a cow, as opposed to I don't know, a lamb or a sheep. I don't know enough about how the skin of these animals are and how they make the cloth. But anyways, that's we do have these distinctions in halakha. I don't know, it doesn't come up too much else often, but we have, of course, the real halachic distinction is between a behema and a chaya. Behema, let's say, was not. That you have to do hisui hadam. When you slaughter an animal, you have to cover part of the blood. You know, the Torah has one of the isuris karet. We spoke last night that the prohibitions where you are cut off from the Jewish people is the drinking of blood, eating of blood. Blood is life, and it's why the Torah originally, we were all vegetarians, and then the Torah allowed the eating of meat. So you have to cover the blood, but you only have to cover the blood of a behemah and an off. You don't have to cover the blood of the chaya. I think I have that right. But you have to cover the blood. And so there are distinctions in halakha.
The other way around.
Yes. The chaya, right. Because a behemah and off are brought in the Mishkan, in the Beit HaMikdash. So since we sacrifice them as animals, we don't have to cover the blood, but we're not allowed to bring a chaya. Let's say, what would be a chaya? I don't know, a buffalo, let's say. In the end of Bikurim, actually, of all places, the mission discusses a koi. It's
a deer.
Yeah, a deer, right. A deer would be a good example. Tzvi, right. Yachmor, right. Different examples. Okay, whatever. So there are important things. Unfortunately, as you see, I'm not so knowledgeable in this area, but, the different types of animals, listen, people lived on farms. Of course, when there was a Beit HaMikdash, obviously these were much more relevant, but, I don't know. Has anybody ever been to a shechtos and they've seen them slaughter an animal? The highest I ever saw was, a lamb. That's the most I ever saw. That was actually when I was in Yeshiva University. Somebody did it, but I went a couple times to a slaughterhouse, but that was only chickens. For when we were in Smicha, we had to go. They say if you go see how they slaughter a cow, you'll become a vegetarian. So no, most of my family's vegetarian anyway. But, the Torah has detailed halachot about these items. Okay. Let's, move on, I hope. Okay, so the other thing I just mentioned at the end, I think during the questions last week, we're talking about the Mishkan and Shabbat, and of course we derive the prohibition of what you're not allowed to do on Shabbat from the things were needed for the construction of the Mishkan. Actually, it's a debate. I think I don't know if it's the Egle Tal quotes this debate. There's a debate. I don't know what the practical difference is. It's the same 39 milachot, but are the milachot the things needed for the construction of the temple as they were building it? I think we generally assume it's not the construction of the temple, it's the running of the temple. In other words, they used to give out the lechem hapanim every Shabbos. Every Shabbos they gave 12 loaves of bread. They split it between the incoming group of Kohanim. We discussed the Mishmarot, right? Tishmaru, right? The Korban Tamid, the hint to the Mishmarot that the Korban Tamid has to be brought by every Jew. We bring it collectively on their behalf of every Jew. But Nuso, you're an Oshkosh, and you know, how they bring the Korban on your behalf. So we divided the entire Jewish nation into 24 Mishmarot. And each Mishmar during their week, the Kohanim would go work and the Levim would go and help, and the Israelim would gather in their quote unquote synagogues and read Masei Bereishit. We discussed that a little bit. So that's how the notion of the Mishmarot. So every week you had a different Mishmar coming and a different Mishmar leaving. So the Lechem Hapanim, the 12 loaves of bread, would get divided between, you know, six and six. Or was it seven and five, I think. I now have to look that up too. Either they divided six by six or they may have divided it seven by five, whatever the two Mishmarot. So that's how you know that baking is prohibited on Shabbos, because they used to bake every week in the Beit HaMikdash, and or the Shtei HaLechem on Shavuot, they used to bake. So the Av Melacha, the prohibition on Shabbat, is baking, the real prohibition. And cooking is a tolta. Cooking is a derivative because it's the same purpose. It's preparing food to eat. But the Av Melacha is baking, and the tolta is cooking. So that's how we generally assume. The things that were needed for the running of the Beit HaMikdash, and the rabbis identified 39 distinct categories needed for the running of the temple, and that becomes prohibited in Shabbos, as we all know. I think we all know that was not, that's not written anywhere in the Torah, though, except to light a fire. The Torah doesn't really tell us what we're not allowed to do. Maybe plowing, that's a debate. Is plowing referring to Shabbos or Shemitah? But there's very little. That's the rabbis interpreting how the Torah, by the Torah juxtaposing the Mishkan and Shabbat. So that's how we know that you're not allowed to do the work. I think I mentioned, Heschel famously, he talks about Abraham Joshua Heschel, about the Shabbat, the Kedushat Hazman, the sanctity of time. And basically, you weren't allowed to build the Mishkan on Shabbat because the sanctity of time is more important than the sanctity of space. The Shabbat overrules, the Kedushat HaZman is more powerful than Kedushat HaMakom. But then we left the question. I said, I'd begin if people were interested this week. So why can the Mishkan run on Shabbos? It's almost an oxymoron. On the one hand, you're not allowed to build the Mishkan on Shabbat. And the things you're not allowed to do on Shabbat are derived from the Mishkan. And the Mishkan runs on Shabbos. Like, there's no Shabbos in the Mishkan. It's just everything you brought. Korbanot. And there are more Korbanot on Shabbat than on the weekday. Extra Korban Musaf. So why is the Mishkan allowed to run on Shabbat? That doesn't make any sense. Does anybody want to suggest a couple answers? You don't have to, but why can, like, I would think of all things that creative activity would have to cease, of course, in the Mishkan. That's where it's derived from. The whole notion of Shabbat is derived from the Mishkan. So why does the Mishkan operate on Shabbat? So I'll quote two answers. Rev Yosef Tzvi Rimon. I don't know if everybody's heard of him. If you haven't, you should have heard of him. He's now the Rav of Alon Shvut. He has these wonderful books, very clear writing with diagrams, and he's a big Talmud Chacham. And like I say, the Rav Alon Shvut, and he puts out all these beautiful books. And so he has now put out, and some of them are translated into English. He has one on Shemitah. I don't know that they're all translated into English. So he has on Shabbat, I don't know, pretty recently put out a two-volume set. So he goes through, he discusses this issue a little bit, and he gives two approaches to this question. Number one is a very interesting, it says, why do we keep Shabbat? The first reason we keep Shabbat is to recognize that God is the creator of the world. God created the world in six quote-unquote days and rested, quote-unquote, whatever that means, on the seventh. So we have to emulate God. That's the first message of the Torah. We're God's partners. We're created with Tzelem Elohim. So everything God does, we have to do. So we have to recognize God is the creator of the world. That's very important because man is so advanced. We think we know it all. So we need a day where we can't create. God is the master creator. No, that we only need in Toronto, in New York, even in Jerusalem. But you don't need that in the Beit HaMikdash. The Beit HaMikdash is suffused with the presence of God is where God dwells. That's whatever that means. But Vasuli Migdash Vishachanti Bitocham. God's dwelling place is in the Beit HaMikdash. Beit Tfilati Yikare L'chol Amim. It's my house. That's where God is. So God is sort of, the presence of God is all over the place. We don't need that extra reminder. It's a very kind of interesting answer that we don't need any extra reminders of the prohibition of work. And therefore, in the temple, we basically ignore Shabbos. Things run like they do. By the way, I mentioned it's a Beit Tfilati, right? Vaviotim El Harkot Shivas Yimachdim Beit Tfilati. We spoke a couple years ago in our Pirkei Avot class that that's the Gemara as this very anthropomorphic, right? That's the word, right? Anthropomorphic comment that God prays. Vaviotim El Beit Tfilati. We said it in the Haftorah on Tani Dester. You should come to my house of prayer. So my house of prayer means that where everybody prays. That's what it really means. But the Gemara interprets my house of prayer that God prays. In other words, my house of prayer, I'm praying. That's pretty wild. What does it mean God prays? We discussed that a couple years ago, but we won't get into that now, maybe afterwards. But because the Beit HaMikdash is a Beit Tfilah, that's why we have, according to the Talmud Yerushalmi, when Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbat, everybody agrees. We blow shofar when in the Mikdash, right? Rosh Hashanah Shekaliyot b'Shabbat, Yantar Shor Shanah b'Mikdash Yutokim v'Alo b'Medina. They used to blow the shofar in the Beit HaMikdash. The question is why? So the Talmud Bavli says, because it's only a rabbinic prohibition not to blow shofar on Shabbos, because we're afraid you may carry. It's the more famous thing, whatever that means. It's wild. But we're afraid somebody's going to carry the shofar, so the whole Jewish people don't blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. That's the Babylonian, you tell me. But the Talmud Yerushalmi has a different reason, and that's because the Beit HaMikdash is a Beit Tfilah. It's a house of prayer. And shofar, as Rav Soloveitchik so beautifully and often explained, shofar is prayer without words. We don't know what to say. Words are limiting. So that's why we blow the shofar in the middle of the Shmon Esrei on Rosh Hashanah. So shofar is the ultimate form of prayer. So it, of course, it has to be in the Beit HaMikdash. It's the Beit HaMikdash is a Beit Tfilah. It's God's Beit Tfilati. So therefore, you have to blow the shofar. It's nothing to do with binnik, biblical. We blow the shofar in the temple. The temple operates in a different sphere because it's God's presence. So that's the first answer he gives. We don't need the reminder of Shabbat in the Beit HaMikdash. The second answer he gives us, is that, what happened? God created the world in 6 days, right? Whatever. And then he rested on the seventh. Okay. And what happened afterwards? The world continues. The world operates on Shabbat. It's not like the world doesn't operate. In other words, creation was finished, but the world doesn't take a day off every seventh day. The world continues to exist. And the Mishkan is basically God's, in other words, the beginning of the Torah, Bereshit, is God building a world for man, and the Mishkan is man building a world for God. It's the parallel, right? Again, we're God's partners. So if God creates a world for us, we have to create a world for God. But that world operates 24/7. Once it's created, in other words, in the process of creation, we have to have this day of rest. But once the world is created, we no longer have to rest. So the same way God rested on the seventh, but the world continues to operate. So the Mishkan, I don't know, whatever, those are two of the answers given. Why? You would think it's very strange why the Mishkan or the Beit HaMikdash operates on Shabbat like nothing happened. And you bring all the korbanot. Okay. Any questions, comments? Okay, let's get back to, was the menorah lit on Shabbat? Yes, as far as I know, yeah, absolutely. All the avodah was done. The ketoret was brought, the Beit HaMikdash functioned. As far as I know, there were no restrictions. There were restrictions on the people who came to the Beit HaMikdash. We're coming up to Pesach now. Purim, of course, marks the beginning of Pesach. Shloshim Yom Kona Machag, 30 days before, talk about Pesach. So, the Gemara says they were cleaning the floor. In other words, the Kohanim, they had a lot of blood, thousands of korbanot are brought. So when they, and that was the question we mentioned last week. That's how Hillel got appointed the Nasi. You're not allowed to bring a private korbanot. A private individual cannot bring a korban on Shabbat. It's not, oh, it's not because he's in the temple, now he can violate Shabbat. That's not what it means at all. What it means is Shabbat is the Mishkan, as the representative of the Jewish people, can function on Shabbat. It's not that individuals violate Shabbat. In order for the Mishkan to function, the Kohanim have to violate the laws of Shabbat. But it's not that the Mishkan is a Shabbat-free zone. No, the image would go there. So therefore, things that weren't directly related to the bringing of the Korbanot were not allowed to be done on Shabbat, unless it was a rabbinic prohibition. The rabbinic prohibitions were allowed because of Zrizim Makdimim, or Kohanim Zrizim Haim, as the Gemara says. In other words, what most rabbinic prohibitions are done because the people are lazy and forgetful, and, you know, we take too many risks. So we want to build the fence. We want to put muksa, because really it's okay. It's okay to walk around holding a pen, you know, behind your ear. What's the big deal? But you know what? I might forget. I doodle. I'm listening to a boring shiur. So I doodle a little bit. So it's not the prohibition of holding the pen. So that's what the rabbis added. The rabbis added the prohibition of muksa. Don't even have the pen. That way you're much less likely to come and write. So when those laws didn't apply in the temple, because the aura of sanctity was so great, one would hope, you go to the Kotel, I don't know, whatever, one would hope that the aura of sanctity was so great that, there's no need for the prohibition. And the Gemara says the Kohanim are Zrizim Haim. The Kohanim are there to watch. Like, we have a halacha. Sometimes things you're not allowed to do, but like, let's say you're not allowed to eat before you daven mincha. So that's a little bit of an issue in the summer. We may be going to daylight savings time all year. Boy, would that be a disaster, in my opinion, especially live in Toronto. We'll get the sunrise will be at 9 o'clock in December here. That's, oh my gosh. But okay. Anyways, what was I saying? I threw myself off, right? Yeah. So in the temple, the Kohanim would remind the people not to violate the prohibition. All right. So that's one of the halachot. Let's say you have to daven mincha. You have to daven mincha, you're not allowed to eat. You're not allowed to do anything. So what do you do in the summer when shul's at 8 o'clock? What, you can't eat before 8 o'clock? So if you have a reminder, if somebody reminds you, you have a mincha kavua, there are certain ways around rabbinic prohibitions if you have, markers to tell you what to do. Otherwise, it's not allowed. So that's, we assume the Beit HaMikdash, there's a constant reminder. There's a constant marker. Their Kohanim are protecting sort of that everything's going to run smoothly. So therefore rabbinic prohibitions are allowed. That's the average person who's in the temple. But the temple service as a community service as representative of the Jewish people ran on Shabbat like any other day of the week. There was no distinction. Okay, so let's get back. I said we were almost finished the Korban Tamid in my Kor and Siddur, page 40. Yes.
Can I ask you a question?
Quickly, of course.
We're talking about resting on Shabbos because God created the world in 6 days and stops. So how do you interpret what we say every day in davening? Is God still creating the world?
As the Rav Soloveitchik, that question doesn't bother me. In other words, the original creation is what gets Shabbos, but the world continues to exist. The sun rises because God wants it to rise, whatever. So, that's not, and there's new creations every day. There's new Torah insights, you know, there's new discoveries with creation. God created an incomplete world. That's, you can say that. We know that. Pruvu melorts v'chiv shuha, and conquer the world. So yes, there's new creations every day.
Taught that it means that God is keeping the world in creation without us.
That's also true.
That's
a firmer interpretation. You know, that the world only exists because God lets. I'm giving a more, you know, human interpretation that man continues the process of creation because God gave us the ability, God gave us the mandate to continue the process of creation. But yes, it means both of those things. But like I said, the question doesn't really bother me. I see that, but you know, these psukim are not meant as oh my God, well, how could God create the world in 6 days? He's creating the world now. It's David HaMelech expressing, you know, the idea that every day the world only continues because of God's kindness, and man left to his own devices can destroy the world, as we see, you know, whatever, you know, who knows. Okay. All right. I don't know if that answers your question. I hope a little bit. All right. So now we got up to, we were discussing the Mishmarot and the why we bring sheep, sheep are obedience, and they're in the, you know, why as the our Korban Tamid. So we got up to the expression Ola Tamid. It's a Korban Ola Tamid. It's constant every day, day in and day out, twice a day. That's consistency. Hasuya Bahar Sinai. It was made at Har Sinai. So what does that mean? It was made at Har Sinai. What do you mean, Hasiyah Bar Sinai? So the simple explanation, it was commanded at Har Sinai, but everything was commanded at Har Sinai. Like, what's so special about that? So Rashi says it's referring to the Korban Ola. When before we got the Torah, it's written in Parshat Mishpatim, actually, but Rashi assumes it happened before the Torah. I forgot, I didn't put it on the screen, sharing it. It's in chapter 24 in Shmot about all the Korbanot the Jewish people brought at Mount Sinai. In other words, the connection between Sinai and Korbanot. You know, I don't know if I mentioned this last week. You know, the Rambam's view on Korbanot is sort of like famously controversial. And maybe modern people like the Rambam's interpretation because we don't relate to Korbanot well. So we like the fact that the Rambam, I am speaking here for myself. I don't want to speak for other people, but I think for many people, the Rambam, you know, historicizes really Korbanot are not so wonderful. But we had no choice historically. God couldn't do it with Korbanot. Although I did explain Korbanot can be beautiful, explained even from a modern perspective. It's instead of going out to the restaurant to eat, we go to the Beit HaMikdash and we eat and we share with other people. But it's pretty clear from looking in the Chumash that the Rambam, it's very hard to maintain the view of the Rambam. Korbanot are so central in the Torah. I mean, Vayikra, and Cain and Hevel start with Korbanot. Yes, they created problems, but the Noach brought Korbanot. Abraham built the Mizbeach. In other words, it's natural. It's a natural way, and it's clear how the Torah presents it. It's very, I can understand Eshet Yifat Tohar, that you go to war and you capture a woman, and so the Torah sticks it in, you know, 20 verses as word, and it's a time of war. You already know that's not a good thing. Okay, so I understand the rabbis say, Divrat Torah, Keneged Yetzer Hara. The Torah doesn't really like this law, but the Torah was afraid if it didn't give you an option of how to take a woman war captive, which, you know, I don't know if that's considered a war crime nowadays. I'm not sure. That people would rape and it'd be much worse. So that's clear. I can say the Torah doesn't really like it. And I can say that even by slavery, the way the Torah uplifts the laws of slavery and where it puts it. But it's very difficult to say that the laws of Korbanot are really, the Torah would have preferred a different system. But what can we do? It was too hard in the ancient world, as the Rambam presents it. So it really is quite difficult because Korbanot are so central to everything we do. And it's so central in the Torah. And that's what we're saying, guys. It comes from Har Sinai. In other words, we couldn't get the Torah without the giving of the Korbanot. Okay, that's just, as some say, it's like Sinai, it's permanent, it's beloved, whatever it is, you see the importance of the Korbanot. Okay, so that's okay, pretty much finished the Korban Tamid, and that's the most important part of the Korbanot, we should say in the Siddur. If you're in a hurry and you don't have time, so you can't say all the Korbanot, so at least say the Korban Tamid. That's the one you have to say every day, and that would fulfill, according to those authorities, the biblical mitzvah to say Korbanot could be fulfilled through the recital of the Korban Tamid. Just to quickly say, I looked it up. You know, so the Korbanot had meat and oil and bread, you know, like, right, we had a mixed flour with the oil and have wine libations, you know, we had a nisuach hayayin, of course, on Sukkot, we had nisuach hamayim, we had a water libation, but all year we had wine libations. So you had, you know, esronim and heen, you know, asira, ushlosha esronim, solid michavalav hashem, like, you know, shnei esronim. So just very quickly, just a little bit of the measurements. Aheen, right. It says basically the Korbanot are either a whole heen, a half a heen. No, I'm sorry. A half a heen, a quarter of a heen, or a third of a heen. Heen. Hey, yud nun. What's a heen? How big is a heen? Okay, that's I guess it's been a long time since anybody brought a korban and had to worry about how many heens we had to bring. A heen and a hare, right? Okay, so a heen is 12 lugim. Oh, so what's a lug? So a lug, you should know, if I can say that, because a lug, because when you make kiddush on Friday night, everybody knows you have to have a revit, you have to have a quarter. That's a good, a quarter of what? You have to have a quarter of a lug to revit halug. So you have to have for wine, you have to have on Kiddush Friday night, you have to drink a revit of wine. A revit means a quarter. If it's a quarter of who knows, that can be a lot. You know, I mentioned the famous, the thing I remember, you know, that the Vilna Gaon says, a Talmud Chacham has to have a shminit sheba shminit of gaiva. Even though humility is very important, as we've talked about, in order to be great, you have to have a little arrogance. You can, if you don't think of yourself a little bit great, a little bit, you won't accomplish much. You have to have a little arrogance. So the Gemara says, a Talmud Chacham, a Torah scholar, we have a Torah scholar, you need an eighth of arrogance. Now, so without knowing what it means, we know that means not a lot. An eighth of an eighth doesn't mean a lot, but I don't know. Maybe it's out of a trillion. Then an eighth of an eighth is a lot. So what's an eighth of an eighth? So the Vilna Gaon has a cute word. The Vilna Gaon says the eighth word of the eighth parsha. The eighth word of the eighth parsha. The eighth parsha in the Chumash. I don't know that that's what the Gemara meant. It can't be what the Gemara meant because the Gemara didn't have the parsha of Hashavua then. So this has to, this is a modern, this is an anachronistic explanation. So the Vilna Gaon said the eighth word of the eighth parsha. The eighth parsha is Vayishlach. The eighth word, the first word of the eighth verse in the eighth parsha. So the eighth verse in Parsha Vayishlach is, Katonti mikol achasidim mikol amet. Katonti. Yaakov says, I'm very small. I'm very small. He's praying to God. God, I'm really, you know, I'm very little. You did all this mercy for me. So you have to have an eighth of an eighth. Katonti. You have to have very little. Okay, whatever. It's cute. Maybe it's not cute. So you have to have a revit, a lug. So how much is a lug? So that's a debate. So, we generally assume when I looked it up here, I thought it was a little higher. They quoted here, okay, 86 millimeters, that I've heard before, because kos, the gematria of kos is 86. So 86 milliliters is, I think that translated into 2.91 ounces. It's not very much. We're coming to Pesach. You have to have 4 cups of wine. Now, you don't have to drink the whole revit. You only have to drink a rough revit. You only have to drink the majority. So if a revit is 3 ounces, you have to have 1.5 ounces, 1 point, whatever. So you have to have 6 ounces. You have to drink 6 ounces of wine on Pesach night. So people go crazy. They can't have 4 cups of wine. Can they have grape juice? And, you know, that's a big question. Rav Soloveitchik didn't like grape juice. Rav Moshe Feinstein allowed it. He didn't think it was such a good idea. Arba kosot yayin, wine. I'm not saying I'm not the people have grape juice and my, you know, but I think wine is better. If you're asking me and nobody has to ask me. So I think wine is better. But you only have to drink 6 ounces of wine. Okay. Maybe it's hard to do exactly 1.5, you know, how do you do exactly a half? But anyways, so you multiply that. So in a heen, they're going to be 48 lugim. It's going to be, I guess, 48 times 3 ounces. So what's that? 142 ounces or whatever it is. Can the wine be watered down? All of our wine is watered down. Yeah, that's also true. The wine that we have today, the wine in the time of the Gemara was much thicker, was much, more powerful. Our wine, I don't know, is 12 or whatever percent of alcohol it has in it. So yeah, that's interesting. That still counts as wine. In other words, even though it's watered down, you don't have to have pure wine. And again, I don't know how to make wine and I don't know if I'm not a wine connoisseur, but yes, it's not, I guess there's a certain point where it can't be watered too much, but that's fine. Yes, all our wine. I don't know that we should add water to the wine, but when they make the wine, it's already watered down. Okay. Anyways, that's just to know. And then they do it by eggs and olives, and everybody know how big is their olive, how big. But these heens, it wasn't so much. So you had to have a revit haheen for a lamb. When you brought a lamb, a quarter of a heen. So that's 3 lugim. That's 9 ounces. Not so much, you know. Whatever. 9 ounces of oil. I guess it's not so little either. Okay. You wouldn't put 9 ounces of oil when you made something, right? Okay. All right. And then After the Korban Tamid, the Torah puts in a pasuk. I don't think it's printed in Al Sidurim. It's actually not part of the Korban Tamid. It's from Vayikra Aleph, the first chapter of Vayikra. V'shachadot ha'yerach ha'mizbeach tzafon u'vnei Hashem. You have to slaughter it in the north. Basically, most things in the temple, as we're going to see very soon, were slaughtered in the northern part of the temple. And then the Kohanim have to throw the blood. And I think we've seen in the past, the throwing of the blood is the main part of the Korban. That's what we were discussing before, covering blood. Blood is life. But the most important part generally of any Korban is the sprinkling of the blood on the altar. Okay. With that, I just want to, we're not going to go through all the rest of the Korban in great detail, but I just want to spend a couple minutes on the Ketoret. And then we'll get to Eisa Mekoman, the fifth parak in Masechet Zvachim. That is, you know, some people say the whole thing every day. Very nice. Okay, so let's just quickly, what's the Ketoret? The Ketoret is the incense. So the incense was consisted of how many spices in the incense? You had to bring every day. The Ketoret was brought on the Mizbeach HaPnimi. So if you know, if you remember from Yom Kippur, or from the last time we learned Vayikra in depth, or the earlier parshiyot, so there were two Mizbechot, there were two altars. There's the, what we call the Mizbeach HaChitzon, the outside altar, which is the copper altar, or the Mizbeach HaPnimi, the internal altar, that's the Mizbeach HaZahav, the golden altar, and it was different size. It was totally different size, much higher and square, much narrower, but taller. And the Mizbeach HaKitzon, the outer Mizbeach had a base of 32 amot by 32 amot. How big is an amah? That's once we're talking on measurements today. How big is an amah? Somebody's going to answer me, no? How much is an amah? You can walk 2,000 amot outside of your city. So that's, nobody does that. But if you're in the cottage, how much is in an amah? 18 inches. So, right. So, you know, no, an amah is from your elbow to your middle finger. That's an amah, right? Now, how big is that? It depends how tall you are. So the real answer, I remember Rav Schachter telling us this also, the real answer is that the Gemara wasn't very concerned. We live in a scientific age. An amah was an amah. How much matzah do you have to eat? You have to eat a kizayit. What's a kizayit? You don't have to eat a zayit of matzah. You have to eat around an olive, a little less, a little more. Believe me, when you went to yeshiva, when you went to school in the time of the Mishnah, you didn't come home with a chart, with a thing that the romaine lettuce has to be 6 by 8 inches. And you didn't come up with this. They didn't do things like that back then. Rav Schachter told us that his father-in-law, who was a Rosh Yeshiva in Telz in Europe, told us that they had a Pesach Seder. Five Rosh Yeshivas were at the Pesach Seder. I guess they had in the Yeshiva. They ate a total of one matzah for the bracha of Al-Achilat Matzah. The kizayit grew in the 1950s, as Chaim Soloveitchik describes in his article that I quote all the time, Rupture and Reconstruction. But it's a kizayit. The Gemara didn't really care. I have a minimum share, but it's not the scientific age we lived in. They didn't have the fourth down marker, you know, to go fourth in inches, you know, goal line, you know, 1 inch, you lose the football game, you know, like, right. They didn't do things like that. They had approximations. So, you know, it looks like an olive that's big enough. So an anama is not an exact amount. It's, you know, it's whatever. It's from the elbow to the finger. Today, we live in such a science. It's hard for us. We don't think like this. That's crazy. I mean, every person had a different ama. So, yeah, I guess so. But I don't think anybody measured it directly. So that they... On a certain level, they did do that. The Gemara was concerned, Natate Shirim L'chol Adam. You can't have everybody do their own thing. But a lot of these things, the Gemara wasn't so concerned. It's good enough. It looks good. It's, you know, you don't need a magnifying glass to check. So today, an Ama is anywhere between 18 and 24 inches. An Ama is anywhere between 18 and 24 inches. Let's say it's 18 inches. So the Mizbeach HaKitzon was 32 amot. That's 48 feet, 50 feet by 50 feet. By the time you got to the top at 10 amot, it was 28 by 28 because you had ramps like going around. So it indented it. either 28 by 28 or 26 by 26. You think of a barbecue grill. It's really what it was. A big barbecue, let's say about 40 feet by 40 feet. It's like bigger than a lot of backyards, you know, like 40 feet wide. That's a pretty wide, you know, some houses are built on 40 foot lots. On 40 feet in backyard, the whole thing was the grill. And that's where they, you know, bring, and you had fire, esh tamid to karon mizbeach lo tichveh. So that was the size of the outer altar. You had a ramp of 32 amot, going up. It's a pretty steep angle, actually. 32 amot to get up to 10 amot. So it's only like a 3-to-1 ratio. Get to 9 amot, really. Cause the last amot was, you know, reached up. So 32 going this way and 9 going this way. That's a pretty steep incline. When the mathematicians here can tell me what that angle is. And, that was the outer Mizbeach. That's where basically all the korbanot were brought. Kimat, all the korbanot were brought. Then you had the Mizbeach on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, you brought the part, the Kohen Gadol brought it inside. And of course, inside, only the Kohanim, that was in the Kodesh, not the Kodesh Kodeshim, that any Kohen could go to. The outside, the Azara, that, anybody who was Tahor could go there. But in the Kodesh, where the menorah, the Shulchan, and the Mizbeach HaZahav were there. The Shulchan, the table, that's where they put the 12 loaves of bread, Bishul on Shabbat that we started with. The Lechem HaPanim, that was put on the Shulchan, and it was there from, it could never leave. It had to be Tamid. That's also a debate. Does it really mean that literally it could never leave? That's how I think the Gemara comes to the conclusion. They would sort of slide one loaf of bread. It would stay there all week. And as they take away last week, they put this week's. And that was one of the 10, that was one of the miracles in the temple. The bread stayed fresh for a whole week. They cooked it on Friday and they ate it the following Shabbos, 8 days later. So, that's the Lechem HaPanim was on the Shulchan. Then you had the menorah. You had to light the menorah. And then you had the Mizbeach. Mizbeach Hazab, Mizbeach Mi'or, something called Mizbeach HaKtoret. That's the Mizbeach where they put the incense. These, as Morris points, or somebody pointed out, the 11 spices. The 11 spices were in the Ktoret. Why 11 spices? Was Heista, whoever, 11? 10's a minion, 3, 5, whoever heard of 11? I don't know any other thing in Judaism. I guess Acharazar Kochvaya, you know, Acharazar Miyodeya, 12 stars in Joseph, 11 stars in Joseph's dream. Okay, great. That's not so great. why 11? So if I were 9, you'd ask me why 9? That's what that's how the Rambam says. Why often, very often, why 7 candles in the menorah? Well, if it would be 8, you'd ask why 8. But again, lots of people don't. We like to find meaning in these numbers. Sometimes there really isn't meaning, perhaps. But so 11 probably does have meaning. Why? Because one of the important one of the 11 spices was the chalbana. Right? If you read the Ktoret, where does it go here? Not the v'shchele chalbana. Samim ulevona zaka bad v'vad. Yeah, okay. Make court. What's the chalbana? So I don't know. How do they translate that? Fragrant spices, balsam, onchki. I don't know how to pronounce it. Galbanum, pure frankincense, etc. So the Gemara says the chalbana. Maybe this people have heard of, had a really bad smell. You wouldn't go near the place. It was like really gave a foul smelling odor. But you brought it with 10 great spices and it would cover up the smell of the chelbana. So, and the Gemara uses this as to teach us that any fast day that doesn't include the Poshe Yisrael, I think that's the expression, Poshe Yisrael, again, I forgot, whatever, I didn't bring it up, but that's a Gemara in Kritut, I believe, that any Gemara, any fast day that doesn't include the sinners of Israel is not a fast day. The Jewish people, you can't daven in the shul with 10 Rosh Hashivas or whatever. 10, you have to daven with the Hamonam. At Sibur, right? That's the Sibur. It's Tzadik, a Benoni, and a Rasha. Okay, that's cute, whatever. But what does this Sibur mean? Let's aver, to gather together. That's be everybody. So we don't, what kind of a community is it where we don't let sinners in? Only the pure can come in. So that's what the Gemara says. Any fast day that we come together to do tshuva and to repent, you have to invite the sinners. And of course, we all know what's the first thing we do on Yom Kippur. Al dad hamakom, whatever you say, hey, anu matirim li palel ima avar yarnim. We permit ourselves. That's actually a pretty weak word. Based on what I'm saying, it should be a stronger word. But whatever, we allow ourselves to daven with the sinners. Maybe that's talking about ourselves. Whatever. But so what I heard from one of my teachers, is that cute? Okay. That's why there have to be 11 spices. So you want a minion of basic people who, I mean, everybody sins, but you want people, a minion of 10 nice, honest, decent, religious people. And then you can invite in all the sinners. That's like Abram. You need Storm. You need 10 people in Storm to save the city. You have to have a base of religion, but I think there's a beautiful idea that we don't talk about enough, that the Chavana was part of the Ketoret. And like I said, the Ketoret brought the inner Mizbeach, the smoke went up to heaven. And the Mishnah in Yuma, if you want to learn about Ketoret, you read Yuma, which is many of the descriptions of the daily temple is in Masechet Yuma. That's hinting to the fact that basically Yom Kippur is just a elevated status of every other day. In other words, the Mishnah describes how the Ketoret was different on Yom Kippur than every other day. But it's Ketoret. In other words, it's the same thing. Yom Kippur just has a elevated status of that. So a lot of the, 7 of the 8 chapters Masechet Yuma, the day, Yom Kippur, deal with the temple service, but not all with the Yom Kippur temple service. The 8th chapter deals with Yom Kippur like we know, when to fast, when not to fast. But the first 7 chapters deals with the temple service, but much of it deals with the daily temple service. And then we discuss, of course, the special service on Yom Kippur. But I think it's also instructive. We do have Masechet Tamid, we'll get there, we do, but that a lot of the laws of the daily sacrifices are incorporated into the Masechet on Yom Kippur. The Mishnah says in Yuma, we discussed a few weeks ago by the, what was I going to say? Hold on a second. We had the lottery on the Truma Hadeshen, the people who were, they got into a fight, and one guy, he killed his guy, and then insane father said, oh, is my son's alive? Let me pull out the knife before it becomes Tame, because he's going to die soon. I mean, the insanity of how religious fervor can allow you to kill people and even your own, really unbelievable. But we know that's true. We know that's true. So they used to have a race up the 32 Amot, the 48 feet of that ramp. They had a race to see who could take out the garbage, clean out the Trumat Hadeshen. So they had 4 lotteries in the Beit HaMikdash. So the second lottery was who was going to bring the Korban Tamid. Only nine priests were needed to bring the Korban Tamid. 9 priests every day, that's not so many. Even if you divide the priests into 24 categories and then to 6, 6 subsections, there's still hundreds of Kohanim in the temple every day. So 9 of them brought, so they had a lottery who would get the merit. And then they had a lottery who could bring the Ketoret. And the Gemara says that lottery you can only win once in your life. It's like, you're only allowed to win, like if a guy wins Lotto 649, I don't know what's it called in America. I don't know what the lottery is called here. Lotto 649. So, a guy wins once. That's amazing. He wins twice. Wow, that's like unheard of. He wins 3 times, he goes to jail. There's something wrong here. But here the Ketoret, that was a bad joke. I'm sorry. The Ketoret, you could only win once. The Gemara says, I don't know what it means exactly. It was, it helped you to become wealthy. I think they say that by a Sunduk also. No, is that said? I don't know. I've never been a Sunduk. Do they have such a concept? Maybe people are Sundukim here it can help you to be wealthy. I'm not sure. Anyways, that's not in the Mishnah. But the Ketoret, they would have a lottery in the temple. And the 4th lottery was who would bring the Korban Tamid was done in 2 stages. They would put the pieces of the animal, the various parts of the animal that they would sacrifice on the ramp, and then they would take it from the ramp to actually put it on the altar. So that was divided into 2 lotteries. So that's what the Mishnah, they had 4 lotteries. It's a we're Purim. We're Motzei Purim. Purim is a lottery, right? Rav Soloveitchik, I wrote a whole other thing, why Yom Kippurim, right? Rav Soloveitchik in his article on why Yom Kippur is a day like Purim. Yom Kippurim, he said, life is a lottery. Purim is all about lotteries. That's why it's called Purim. The Megillah says so. The Megillah says, it's called Purim. You know, it's because of the lottery. New, what's Yom Kippur all about? Lottery. Which Sa'ir is the Sa'ir Lashem, Sa'ir Lazel? So much lottery. That sounds so un-Jewish. Haman makes a lottery. That I get it. We don't believe in gambling. It's not a Jewish idea, but Yom Kippur is all about lottery, right? And Rav Soloveitchik explains because that's our claim to tshuva. Our claim to repentance is that life is a lottery. You know what? God, you know, you may be born in North America in the 20th century. How do you expect a Jew to be religious in the atmosphere of the decadent West? I don't mean it like, but you know, how do with the temptations that are out there and the move and the glorification, the sex and the violence and the television and the internet, it's impossible. And there's so much and there's so much. No, how do you, God, you know, if I would have been born into Shtetl in Poland, I'd be a nice religious Jew. I wouldn't have that. So that's how the Rav writes that, the Davs and Reflections of the Rav, that, you know, that's our claim to God. God, it's your fault. You know, what do you expect from people? It's like the Gemara says, you dress up a kid very nice and you put him outside a house of prostitution. Well, what do you think is going to happen? Like, that's what the laws of Yichud are all about. Why men and women who aren't married can't be alone together in the room, because normal people, things are going to happen that we don't want to happen. So our claim to God is we do our best, but, you gave us a, you know, you put us in a situation. It's a pretty audacious claim. It's a pretty wild claim. But that's how we come to God. That's why I'm sure there are more ideas, but that's one of the ideas the Rav expresses, why we say Yom Kippurim. Yom Kippur is a day like Purim, and our claim to tshuva is that it's Purim, it's lots, that we were given sort of, I don't say a bad hand. I'm glad we were born in America in the 20th century, where despite all the problems in the world, you know, it's hard to think of a better time to be born for anybody. The wealth and the comfort and the everything that we have, and better time to think of a time where it'd be more peaceful. I mean, it's hard to say after the generation of the Holocaust. I guess I'm born post-Holocaust, and except, but you know, today afterwards, today it's a Jew, you know, anti-Semitism is out of style. Despite the problems, I understand, of course it isn't perfect, but put in historical perspective, it's hard to think of a time when you would want to have been born a place as a Jew than now in, you know, in the West, or even, you know, I understand Jews in Ukraine don't think that way, and for tragic reasons, of course, but fundamentally, this is a wonderful place. But anyways, that's Yom Kippurim, it's the lottery. So it is interesting, Masechet Yuma describes the four lotteries they had in Beit HaMikdash. So much of life is a lottery, right? I mentioned last night, I mentioned all the time. Hilchot Tzedakah is based on this notion, right? No matter how much you do, there's so many factors beyond your control that determine if you're going to be wealthy or not wealthy, you know? So when God blesses you with wealth, things go right, things align right. For every person who's bright and works hard and makes $1 billion, there are 50 other who are just as bright, who work just as hard and didn't make $1 billion. They didn't get the luck of the draw, you know? Or you're in the travel business in the pandemic. Like, what are you going to do? Like, it's not your fault. But that's how life works. Life is a lottery. So, and the lotteries are described in Masechet Yuma, of all places, like the holiest day of the year, so to speak. It's a fascinating idea. So that's, we have the Ketoret is done. So you can read the Ketoret. Okay, that's, so we go through the Ketoret, Pitum HaKetoret, Ketzah, Shlosh Meot V'Shishim U'Shmona Manim. There were 368 pieces, and then 365 for the 365 days of the solar year, because our calendar is solar lunar. But then it switches. He had three extra to use on Yom Kippur. I've never quite understood that, because Yom Kippur is the solar, is the lunar year. Like 368 doesn't work with Yom Kippur, right? We never have our holidays 365 days apart. Either it's 11 days earlier or 19 days late. Sometimes 12 days earlier, 10 days, sometimes 19, 20, depending on, you know, little tweaks in the calendar. But we know we have, the calendar is either 354 or 383 in a standard year, or 384. 384 and is in adding a month. So 354 to 384, sometimes one day less, one day more. So basically Yontif is always 11 days earlier than last year or 19 days later. So this year, I don't know, Pesach, well, last year Pesach was March 27th. No, I think March 27th at night. So I think it's actually 20 this year, but add 19, that's four. That's the 15th. It's the 15th. I think Pesach is April 16th. Whatever it is, but you get the idea. Anyways, the Mishnah goes through the Mishnah here. It's the Gemara goes through the whole cycle of how the korat was offered, listing all the spices, etc. Okay, what I want to do now, and then the Gemara lists off the order of the Beit HaMikdash. Maybe I'll come back to that if you want to introduce Eizu Makoma. That's a little bit more well-known and a little bit more famous. Eizu Makoma, Shozvachim, Koshe, Koshim, Yitam, Etzapon. So I guess, please God, next week we'll go through some of it inside. What I want to do this week is just by mentioning that I imagine if I'm going to ask people, why remember? What we're doing now is learning Torah as part, right? La'olam yishalesh adam tamud. You have to learn three genres of Torah every day. Tanakh, Mishnah. Mishnah means straight law and Gemara, analysis. So Rabbi Yishmael, this is the second cycle, right? The first cycle was Yivarach Hashem Yishmaracha, Eilu Dvarim Shelem Shiur, Eilu Dvarim Shadam Achol Perotem Olam Hazeh, Karen Kim Olam Abad. That was one cycle of learning. And now we've been doing for many weeks the second cycle of learning. And why it's picking from the Korbanot, because Tefillah is connected to Korbanot. And, you know, but our second stance of learning. So we have the psukim of the Korban Tami. That's what we've gone through the last couple of weeks. Then we have the Mishnah of Eizu Makoman. That's what we're going to do now. And then we're going to have the Gemara of Rabbi Yishmael Omer, B'shloshetor Midot HaTorah Midrash Pem. So the rabbis could have picked anything. So again, they're picking Korbanot. So that's, but why else? I think there is a reason I've heard many people say, why was Eizu Makoman picked as the chapter that we're going to say of Mishnah every day? Maybe rotate them like we do the Shir Shalyom. That's, you'd be much more, you'd learn more, you know, do that Daf Yomi and Mishnayos, like just every, you know, every day do a different character, 525, you know, Prakim in Mishnah. Actually, not a bad idea. Maybe I should raise that. I say it jokingly, but I mean it seriously. Instead of saying Eizu Makoman, every day have a new chapter in Mishnah. That's where you say your Mishnah. In a year and a half, you'll do the entire Mishnah. Maybe you won't understand it 100%, but I don't know how many people understand Eizu Makoman. So 525 chapters, that's all it takes to finish all Mishnah. About 4,200 Mishnayot, I think, you know, something like that. It, by the way, I would recommend that over Daf Yomi for most people. That's the time, because you'll first of all, you get a much broader education. As you'll see my Dvar Torah that I'm sending out, please God, after the Shir, only 37 of 63 Masechtot have Gemara. So half of Shas, half of the Torah, you don't learn when you learn Daf Yomi. You don't learn Adias, you don't learn Peya, Bikurim, Orla, you don't learn half of the Torah. Yeah, it's more than half. In other words, in quantity, more than half of the Mishnayot have no Gemara. We don't learn that in Daf Yomi. And also Daf Yomi, it's very, unless you have a lot of time to spend on Daf Yomi, it's very hard to really to remember it and to follow it and the back and forth. The Mishnah, you'll know all of Jewish law. The Gemara, you know, you don't know after an hour what exactly practical things came out of it. I listen, it's beautiful, those who do it, and it works, and it gives people the power to learn. It's all wonderful. But on a practical level, it'd be, if you do it, if you would spend that same time learning Mishnah, you'd gain a lot more. Most people gain much more. Anyway, but that's not what we do. We say Eizu Makoman every day. The Seder, whatever. We have it every day. But there's no reason it couldn't change, by the way. In other words, it's not like the Amidah or the Shema that you have to say, this really could. It's not a halach in Eizu Makoman. It's a halach of learning in the morning. That is important to state. Okay, so why was Eizu Makoman with that? Why was Eizu Makoman, you know, chosen? So what do they say? No, what's the reason? No, nobody heard this reason. Okay. Who's the author of Eizu Makoman? How many Tanaim are mentioned in Eizu Makoman? Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabbi Eliezer, Hagadol, like who's Marban Gamliel? So none of these people are mentioned. Why are none of these people mentioned? Because there's no machloket. It's all anonymous. There's no machloket. So they say it's the only chapter in the entire Mishnah where you don't have at least one argument. I mean, we argue about everything. So it's the only Masechet. It's the only thing. So that's nice. But it's not the only. It's not the only. It's because people, I think I first noticed it when I was learning Masechet Tamid, the daily sacrifice. And I remember I had heard this as a kid and older that we chose the rabbi. It's a beautiful idea. We chose Eitzim V'Kon because there's no machloket. Beautiful, peaceful, getting along together. Beautiful idea. Beautiful. And then they were, it's the only one in the Talmud. So that's kind of sad. Out of the 525 chapters, only one of them is unanimously agreed upon. But then I'm learning Masechet Tamid. Who learns Masechet Tamid? And I notice, holy, there's no arguments here. There's seven chapters. B'shloshim makomim akonim shomrim beit hamikdash begins the three places the Kohanim would watch, guard around the beit hamikdash. Seven chapters, two little arguments in the whole Masechet. Most of Masechet Tamid has no arguments. I think there are a couple here. So it's not exactly true that it's true that there's no, it's unanimous. And it's almost the only chapter in the Talmud that has no debate. But of course, it's related. And it's not a coincidence. Masechet Tamid, I mean, this is in Zvachim. Eitzim V'Kon is the fifth chapter in Zvachim, in Kodshim, the Kodshim section of the Mishnah. Tamid is also in Kodshim because it deals with the Talmud service. They're pretty close to each other. So it would make a lot of sense. It would make a lot of sense that there would be very little machloket in the temple service. We discussed the Kohanim are Zrizimim. You can do rabbinic prohibitions. They were careful. Why is a lot of machloket? So we'll have to pick up on this next week. We spoke about it in Berkei Avot a little bit. Not all machloket is good. The machloket is sometimes people weren't paying attention. They didn't fully understand. So they don't remember. And Hillel and Shammai aren't alive anymore to ask them. So Beit Hillel, oh, this is what he meant. This is what he meant. And they start arguing. So a lot of it is really bad. The temple was very good. The temple, the Kohanim are careful. And obviously, this is very important in, you know, service. So they would be very careful. There are lots of people there. So you do the Korban Tamid the same way every day. It's the same 11 spices in the Torah every day. It's the same heen, you know, the same lugim, the same every single day. They would have it. By the way, they did have cups in the Beit HaMikdash. I don't want to say that these measures didn't matter exactly. Maybe I was too, but there is a kizai. That is true. But the Mishnah does mention they actually had the, like we have, a cup. This is 8 ounces, you know. So they, and we, and everybody has those measuring cups at home, you know, half a cup, quarter of a cup, a third of a cup. So they have those in the Beit HaMikdash, 7 cups, half a lug, a quarter of a lug. So they did come up with a measurement for the, in the temple there, because they had to do something. But anyway, so that's what you have a lot in the Beit HaMikdash. So it's interesting that the only Masechtot where there's no debate are those relating to the running of the Beit HaMikdash, because that was run very carefully. Just like we know Kohanim, you know, Kohanim keep their pedigree, whatever the word is, very, very carefully. And you know that even Kohanim were totally not observant. They know they're Kohanim. They know they duchen, or they don't go to funerals. You know, you have Kohanim where they eat pork, but they won't go to a funeral. I'm a Kohen. A Kohen doesn't become Tameh. Like it's a beautiful thing that they have this something about being a Kohen. That's how Carl Skorecki is from Toronto, his, you know, research on the Kohen gene. You know, his famous article that only Kohen, people know what I'm talking about, right? He's a nephrologist, I think. Brilliant. He won the gold medal at the University of Toronto. He graduated high school with the highest mark in the whole province of Ontario. Went to Harvard and he made Aliyah. He's a firm guy, and he's a Kohen, and he's in Shul one Shabbos, and right after makes Aliyah, and the Yemenite Jew gets the Kohen Aliyah, says, holy cow, our great grandfather was Aaron a Kohen, and we're so different. So he started doing research. So he discovered but I don't know what it's called in science. He published it in Nature magazine, the Kohen gene, that there's a marker, like 99.4% of Kohanim have it, and like 0.2% of other people have it. In other words, it's Kohanim, and it runs through this marker, this genetic marker runs through the male side of the, obviously, and the heredity. So, you know, it's very fascinating. Kohanim, it sort of demonstrates Kohanim were very careful to keep their, you know, kahuna status intact. So that would make a lot of sense that in the temple there was very little debate. Okay, we have to stop here. Let's just do a very quick review. We've talked about why on Shabbat the Mishkan can run. If we learned the laws of Shabbat from what we're not allowed to do on Shabbat, what they did and building the Mishkan or running the Mishkan, how can the Mishkan run on Shabbos? We don't need Shabbos in the Mishkan. God's presence is so great. We know he's the creator. Very fascinating answer. Or in a sense, the same way God, it's true, God rested on the first Shabbos, but the world continues to exist in the same way God created for us. We create for him a Mishkan, and then it continues to exist afterwards. We discussed Asiya Bahar Sinai, the notion Korbanot are linked to the giving of the Torah, the Korban Tami. Then it's the Rambam view is sort of hard to maintain through a simple reading of the Torah where Korbanot plays such a central role in everything that we do and every special event, of course, all the Yamim Tovim, the special Korban Musaf. So Hasuya Bar Sinai, the Korban Tamid sort of emanates just like the Torah, Aseret HaDivrot, everything comes from Sinai. Korbanot is part of that same our same structure. And then we discussed the Diktorat. Diktorat is a symbol of all Jews. It's in the inner sanctum, you know, so to speak. There's the outer and the inner, Mizbechot, the Mizbech HaZahav inside, and only Kohanim, but it had the 11 spices to symbolize those Jews who sin. And without sinners, we're not a community. Sinners have to be welcomed. Again, I'm not talking about the halachic limits and what do that. That's not the point. The point is the Jewish community consists of all types of people. As somebody wrote, I said, Tzibur, Tzadik, Beinoni, Rishim, and they all have to be part of our community. And then we, that was the lottery. We discussed the idea of lotteries. It's really like strange, especially on Yom Kippur, but that's where the four lotteries are discussed. And that's Rav Soloveitchik, Yom Kippurim. Purim is a lottery. Yom Kippur is a lottery. Life is a lottery. We have to make the best of the hand we're dealt with, but we can complain to God. God, give us a second chance, a third chance, a tenth chance, because, you know, we didn't get such a good, our ticket's a non-winning ticket. And then we just introduced the idea of Eisa Makoman, which we'll get to next week a little bit more, describing the sacrifice, the various sacrifices. It's one of the very few, but not the only chapter that has no debates, no machloket. The other ones, and there may be others, but the other ones, I know five of them at least, in Tamid, which deals with the daily Beit HaMikdash because of the unity and the sanctity they kept in the temple that they didn't let, or they tried not to let machlokets creep in. We'll discuss next week where machloket did creep into the temple. It creeped in so much the temple was destroyed because, the Sinat Chinam wasn't necessarily in the temple. Okay, thank you very much. A pleasure to see everybody, especially after Purim. I want to wish everybody Shushan Purim, Purim Sameach, as we discussed last night. Purim is a two-day holiday, even in outside of Shushan, even outside of Yerushalayim, and have a Shabbat Shalom. Just let me see if there's any comments that I missed. I thought there was a measuring stick of the Yama. Maybe, probably, I have to check, but like I said, they had the measuring sticks for the Heen and the Lug, that they for sure had. Did they have for an Yama? I don't know why they needed an Yama. You didn't really need an Yama. As far as I know, the Mishnah said they had, I forget, I'll look it up, it's in Zvachim, 7 of 1, for liquid and solid, they have different measuring cups. Liquids and solids are different. I don't recall the Mishnah saying anything about an Amah, and I don't even know where you would need it. Once everything was built, I don't know nothing in the Beit HaMikdash, as far as I can think of, that a Korban or anything has anything to do with an Amah. It has to do with Heens and Lugs, but it doesn't have to do with Amot. That, as far as I know, doesn't exist, but I don't know. It could be. Thank you. Word Sibur, yeah, that's what we said. Daily renewal of the word by Hashem, right? It's a very comforting thought. Okay, yes, 100%. But you know what? God depends on man. I mentioned briefly, you know, God prays. Makon filati, that's where God prays that wild anthropomorphic midrash, that Beit filati that God prays. The simple implication of that, the heretical implication of that, but the Kabbalists picked up on this, is that God is needy, because you only pray if you have needs. Who's God praying to? But God needs the Jewish people, which the Midrash already says. I think Rashi quotes it. By Hebrew Shurin Melech, Mitasei Frosh Hayam. That in the Habracha, you can only be a king if you have servants. So God needs the servants of the Jewish people, otherwise he's not a king. So on a certain level, God needs man. I don't want to uncomfort you. Yes, it is very comforting that God is running the world every day, and there is a daily renewal, but I think a lot of that daily renewal is also man. We're partners with God, and I don't want to say God can only do so much. That doesn't sound right. But on a certain level, it is correct. God, Hester Panim or whatever, but God expects man. God gave man free choice and God doesn't always intervene. We don't know why he does, when he does and how he does. And we have to live our life. I've said many times, I know it sounds heretic. We have to live our life as if there's no God. We always have to have God before us. Shivit Hashem l'negdi tamid, of course. But we also have to, we can't rely on God for anything. Ain't some criminalities. So God will do this. Don't live your life. God will do this. God will do that. God won't do anything. God, you do it. What God will do, he'll do in the background, but we can't live like that. So I know that's not a comforting thought. What can I tell you? There is, ultimately we believe that God, you know, controls the world. I don't know what that means though. Hatikva, let's hope we can have hope. Okay. I hope I didn't depress anybody with that. But I'm very optimistic. I brought my family, you know, be optimistic, look at the good, think things will be good. Yeah, but Seder, as they say in Israel, but it's sometimes you know, you see what's going on in the world. Wow, it's an Olam Sheker. This is really an Olam Sheker. And you know, what can we do? We can let's do our best. All we can do is do our best and hope that might influence God to act in a way that will be beneficial for all of us. Okay. Wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. Don't forget our Pesach program is starting on Monday. Our sort of the ongoing classes are continuing, but the sort of our new classes are picking up next week between Purim and Pesach, beginning 11 a.m. Avram Kowalski giving a three-part series. And you can sign up. And Ari Murmus, we have, I think, five different series going on for Pesach. So I sent out the email. I'll send out another email now that Purim's over. And you can sign up individually for all of the classes. And we look forward to learning with you. And please invite a friend. And everybody be well and enjoy the extra long rest or time to learn Mishnah with Daf Yomi on Shabbos afternoon, now that you have an extra hour for Shabbos. Okay, everybody be well. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a wonderful show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, later. Somebody asking me privately if you're still here. Daylight saving time. Which would you rather have? Later or later family. I'm not sure what that means exactly, but yeah, I don't know why it's so hard for people to change an hour twice a year. Like they go, I mean, people travel all the time. But whatever. And then I'm not sure, we're going to have one time. Should it be daylight saving time or standard time? I don't want it to get, you know, to be sunrise only at 9 a.m, but I also don't want the sun to rise in the summer at 4:30. You know, I can't, want it to go later at night, but anyways. All right. Be well, everybody. Thank you. That should be the biggest problem we have in the world. And then we're okay. All right. Shabbat Shalom.